Hi, it's Leah. Today I'm talking to Brian Hillichman. Brian has spent the past years working on developing a new way of cheaply manufacturing batteries at scale, a problem of critical importance for the process of electrifying the world, while also allowing for the creation of brand new tech. This process has led him from his PhD program to trying to spin out a startup to implement his approach in the real world. Next to the exciting future of electrification and its current bottlenecks, we cover everything from incentive problems in science to what makes for a serious work in both academia and industry. Note that my audio in this episode is not ideal, but since Brian is doing most of the talking, I hope listening will be fun nonetheless. We jump right into a current problem within the field. But if you do not know anything about batteries yet, worry not. The initial problem is a broad one, and for the more detailed part of our discussion, Brian will give a comprehensive intro about 15 minutes in. So without further ado, here's our chat.
So Brian, thanks so much for being here. To get us to a good starting point for talking about the future of batteries and the vast implications, why don't you introduce the field by elaborating on a real granular problem that you see existing today? And assuming you're working on a kind of solution, it would be great if you could connect that to the work you're currently doing.
Sure. So I guess the big problem that's currently limiting the battery space is actually producing cells. And so Tesla, for instance, has said that the fundamental limiting factor on a big transition to cleaner transport is just battery cell production. And the way they make battery cells right now actually uses this technique called tape casting. And so tape casting was first used for batteries back in the 80s when Sony was the one who first commercialized the battery. And it's a technique adopted from the production of VCR tapes. And you need now these huge factories that are using this old technique they used to use to make VCR tapes. And that's the biggest, most capital intensive part of battery production is this slurry coating process for making electrodes. And so a big problem is basically how do you take the stuff they use to make VCR tapes and then use it to make enough VCR tape stuff for all of the cars in the world. And
right.
If you watch Tesla's Battery Day, they're talking about this dry coating technology. That's one avenue for getting away from it. I'm kind of working on something which is a different approach where it's a new type of anode that doesn't need that slurry coating. So again, it's a simplification of the manufacturing process, but really it's the massive scaling of production of battery cells is really the critical problem for transport.
All right. And how long have people been working on figuring out how to improve that manufacturing, and how new is your approach?
My approach is really new and really different. There's a lot of different changes kind of that are associated with the new chemistry. So it's just talking about it in terms of that granular problem. It probably is something people have been focused on explicitly for only maybe 5 to 10 years, because there were so many other problems before that slurry coating wasn't really the thing that was constraining battery development. It used to be way more expensive. And really, we haven't had a major breakthrough in battery chemistry probably for 10 or 20 years. And so really all of the advances have come from better packaging and more efficient factories. And just as a lot of these other costs have been stripped away, this is one that still continues to dominate. So if you look at a battery factory right now, you're going to see these giant ovens that are as big as a football field. And that's just because you need to slowly dry the electrodes. And that's just something which takes a lot of time, and it costs a lot of money to have a football field sized oven.
Right. So what was the catalyst of that change towards improving manufacturing? Was it just an issue of funding? Did some new players come into the field with really new ideas? Or what made the field only explicitly focus on it 5 years ago?
So I think it's probably, and there's so many different aspects of battery manufacturing that I think that people have definitely been working on it for a while. But I guess what happened was batteries used to be really expensive. So the number that people talk about was $1,000 a kilowatt hour. And the raw materials were not as much. The raw materials were let's call it $80 a kilowatt hour. But people just thought that making batteries was a hard thing and that batteries would always have a significant premium. And so if you go back to 2005 to 2010, people would make these pitches that like they would have a transformative technology that would be only $500 per kilowatt hour. But you saw a similar thing that happened with the solar industry or in the mid-2000s, where learning costs, as the technology got deployed at scale, the price just plummeted, and it plummeted way further and way faster than anyone else could have imagined. And so all of a sudden, now it's $100 a kilowatt hour, so it's 10 times cheaper. And as the price of battery storage approaches the raw materials cost, then you really just want to get high throughput manufacturing is the problem, because you're basically making them for free. Like the CapEx is the thing that actually is the additional cost now. So overall, it basically, as all of these other costs have gone away, if you look at what the rate limiting step is, just like if you wanted to make 10 times as many batteries, like where is the factory going to get really expensive? And it would be this slurry coating problem. But this is also, like, it's like definitely something which is very granular. I feel like almost no one would say that like slurry coating is the big thing. It definitely is. And like 100% if you like look from a technical perspective. But I would just imagine anyone who was like a battery scientist who listened to us talk about slurry coating for the first 10 minutes of this or whatever would be at least somewhat surprised. They would probably agree, right. But it's a somewhat narrow granular problem like you had talked about that is super important. But yeah.
So I'm super curious, how did you first get exposed to it then, if it's not even like the consensus in the field, that's really where the focus should lie?
So one of the big things that you should know about batteries is almost nothing works. If you look at how difficult it is to find a material that meets all of the different constraints, it's really hard. Normally we get one breakthrough. Like it took, I would say you could consider like the early 70s is when people started trying to make what's broadly like a lithium ion battery, and it wasn't commercialized until 91. So it took 20 years, and we haven't really had a lot of mechanistic changes since then. So I came to it from a different approach where it was just like, how do you simplify battery manufacturing? And so overall, it was just, that seemed like something that was like a practically viable thing that. And then I basically spent the last 4 years trying to de-risk it and see if it meets all of these other things, because you have a lot of different constraints. And so the slurry coating is a nice benefit, but the big thing that most researchers are focusing on is higher energy density. But the problem is you need like everything at the same time. And so overall, I guess something which I had actually not thought about as explicitly, but that was actually the original motivation, was just simplifying manufacturing. It was just like, if you want something that you're going to be producing millions of tons of per year, it needs to be easy to make. So that's a big problem. So my research is in a field called like alloying anodes. Mm-hmm. Most of the time when people are doing work on that, they do these nanostructures that are like really elegant, but like hard to make a lot of. So that you need to make millions of tons of it. So if you have a really fancy nanomaterial, if you can't make millions of tons of it, it's not as useful. And so my research was just trying to be super pragmatic. And what is a practically doable thing that could work? And then it was just like, but at the same time, it kind of is a little bit more like whole, like gestalt, I guess, because there's just like a lot of different parts that go into it. And like, it's something where from a commercial standpoint, it's one of the most attractive things of the approach that at least I've been working on developing, is the fact that it is just not capital intensive in the same way. But from a scientific standpoint, it's something that, like I said, most academics would not care a ton.
Right. I've actually seen that quite a bit, like the dichotomy between kind of practicality or pragmatism of actually bringing something to market and kind of the prestige of complicated techniques that just stay within the academic cycle. Research isn't necessarily always just focused on the practical outcomes in the real world and making everyone use a product in the end. I wonder how you think about that, whether that's like a big problem to you in your eyes.
It's a little bit of both. And so that's like the strength of the academy and also the weakness. The academy is better suited for pursuing big blue sky ideas. If you're doing too granular of optimizations, that's better left for commercial players who have way more resources and way stronger incentives. Like one of the quotes or one of the like blog posts that I really liked when I was first thinking about grad school, it's talking about like single most practical reason to get a PhD. And the thing the guy came up with is the single most practical reason to pursue a PhD is it lets you spend 4 to 6 years working on something that the market doesn't value in the short term. And like I said, I spent 4 years trying to figure out if I can use foils as like really good anodes. And like most companies would probably not pay me to spend 4 years doing that. And so having some separation from the explicit feedback loop of trying to focus on the next quarter is good. But at the same time, having been doing battery research for 4 to 5 years, especially for any of the battery scientists that follow me on Twitter, I'm pretty disillusioned with a lot of at least some of academic research with batteries. There are a lot of really great scientists, and they're like, I could just list countless names that I respect. But if you just scroll through journals now and you like look at papers, most of them are not, they're not good, if you ask me. I basically find individual groups that I really like, and then there are smart people, and a lot of people are working hard, and it's a really hard problem trying to actually like work on stuff like this. But one of the big things that I like is I like any academic who just takes their work seriously. And so one of the big things is you can try to write a paper that like hides what the big problem with your technology is, or you can write a paper which is studying the big problem and trying to work on it. It's usually easier to write a paper which is, I made the best material ever that works great. And then it's like, why does no one use this? And it's because you're not talking about the giant problem that's there. And so I really respect any academics who like actually are engaging and like I said, taking what they do seriously. Like, I think that batteries and clean energy is super important. I think that it's something that can make the world way better. Like, climate change is a pressing problem of like unthinkable proportions. And so if you're doing work on clean energy, you should like really try to work on something that's, I think it's just taking it seriously is the big thing. Because listen, I think fundamental research can be amazing. Like, I can read papers that have no practical relevance at all, and they help me to understand something in a cool way. Mm-hmm. I can read cool engineering papers that are like, wow, that's actually like a good way to do it. But yeah, the academy, I think sometimes it's like not the best quality work always. Trying to be careful so don't get canceled.
It's all safe here. Is there any kind of like way you can imagine the academy incentivizing people to actually do the work that you put very well, like taking it seriously and thinking hard about the practicality? Or do you think it's just something that every individual kind of has to figure out for themselves?
I think there's definitely some institutional stuff. So one thing recent, like a journal called Joule, which is relatively new, but really high quality. And I published my paper there, so I'm a little bit biased, but I do like them a lot. I think they do good work.
Yeah, saw that.
Like recently, they just published a battery checklist, which is just a fair rubric of reporting metrics that they want everyone to do. And that's a lot of it. So a lot of what battery scientists can do is like play with the metrics they report to kind of obscure things. And so I think having consistent reporting metrics for our community and holding the community to an account and like reviews and stuff as well is like, you should report these things. And like I said, they don't all have to be perfect. They don't all have to be there, but it just makes it way easier to understand claims that are made when they're reported consistently. And so I think there's definitely a role for journals to play like that. As far as broader academic reforms, it's something I'm really interested in, but it's a really hard problem. I don't have any like super clear good ideas on how to change the quality of work in the academy. Not yet, at least. It's something that like I think about a lot. I know that I had like a side project before I had focused more heavily on this project where I was trying to spin up like a commons for scientists doing research. So I made like sciwiki.io is still up. You can go there. And it was like trying to essentially come up with alternative means for the scientific community to aggregate information beyond the formalized publishing environment. I think you can see stuff like Archive is like a really cool example where my understanding, and I could be a little bit wrong in the specifics, is like when you're a scientist and you write a manuscript, you own the manuscript. And then when you send it to the journal and they create final proofs, they own the copyright on the proofs. So with Archive, you can basically publish your paper there before, because like you technically own the manuscript you wrote and they just own the full one. But at the same time, I don't know that solves all the problems either. Like, I don't publish my papers on Archive, and like sometimes it could decrease the likelihood of a prestige journal publishing it if it's already out there online. And so I think the incentives of academic publishing are super important. I think that the system has some problems, but most of them are hard problems. They don't have clear answers. And overall, it's something that I think I'm much more qualified to talk about batteries in almost any level. I can go into that technically. As far as stuff, there's this one guy I really like, David Chapman, He got a PhD in, I think, computer science at MIT, and also was very heavily into Buddhism and writes a lot about phenomenology and like some kind of sociology type stuff. And I think that's maybe a better perspective for thinking about the academy, but I don't know. Overall, wrapping up a PhD, I think a lot of people, it's easy to get disillusioned and complain a lot. So I don't want to just be complaining. Like I said, the academy provided me with wonderful opportunities. And there are tons of very smart, hardworking people there. But it is, like I said, the battery field, I would guess, the percentage of papers that are not good is very high, I guess. I don't
know. Yeah, I appreciate the candid assessment of that. So to bring it back to batteries, like, what do you think are the most ambitious or promising or even important efforts in your field right now? And feel free to mention your own very exciting plans.
So the big thing with batteries is the clear next step is the electrification of transport, which is like a huge problem. It's like something like, I think, about 25 to 30% of global emissions. And so that is something which everyone is trying to figure out a different way. I would say there are broadly two approaches for next generation batteries. Some people are trying to make lithium metal batteries a thing. And so that's like a new anode. And some people are trying to make alloying anodes a thing, which is a new anode.
Just to start in there, anodes and cathodes, can you give us a very brief intro? I know that you have a really good intro to that also that I'll refer people to on your own Medium, but just to give people a quick intro.
For sure, we jumped in the middle, so I can take a half step back, at least outline what batteries are, and then talk about how the field is moving forward. So a battery is a way to store energy. It's really useful way to store energy because it provides on-demand access to electricity, which is like really clean and useful. So stuff like gasoline is a way to store energy as well, but you have to burn it to get the energy out. So it's a little bit more complicated. So the way it does that is it stores energy using chemical reactions. And so the main battery now that everyone uses is like the lithium ion battery. And so when you're using the lithium ion battery, what you're doing is you are, when you're charging it, you're forcing a bunch of lithium into the anode where it doesn't really want to go. And you can imagine this is like pulling a spring. So you're like storing energy. It's not in a super happy state. And then when you're using the battery, the lithium's falling back downhill into the cathode where it's happy and you're like getting back some energy. So that's like pulling a spring and letting it go is what you're doing every time you're charging your phone, but you're forcing lithium into the anode and then it's falling back into the cathode. So the modern anode and cathode were developed, I would say, from about 1970 to 1990 was like in the broadest strokes, the class of materials. And so basically, do you want me to go through the history of how we got to the modern battery?
Yeah.
I think that might be helpful.
Sure.
So the story generally starts with this guy, Stanley Whittingham. He was working at, I believe it was Exxon, but it might have been Shell. And he came up with a battery where it used a lithium metal anode and this titanium sulfide cathode. And so it was the same type thing where you could push lithium in from the cathode to the anode and back and forth, and then you could store energy. But the big problem with that was that lithium metal likes to catch on fire a lot, and it also doesn't really cycle super well. And so it was like all the early batteries that they tried to make caught on fire, and they're like, lithium metal's bad. So then in the 1980s, Dr. John Goodenough, he came up with this new cathode that already had some lithium in the cathode, so you didn't need the lithium metal anymore. And this was lithium cobalt oxide. And so like metal oxides like rust, so it's like iron oxide is what, if you have iron and you let it rust, so this is cobalt oxide. So cobalt has some weird solid state chemistry stuff, which makes it perfect. Dr. Goodenough kind of looked around and he's a smart guy and he was like, cobalt, that's the one, that's pretty great. So he found the cathode and that could let you get rid of lithium metal, but there wasn't an anode yet. And so it was actually in Japan. Yoshino is the third. And so they just gave out the Nobel Prize for this. And these are the three they credit with inventing it. And so Yoshino threw it together where he took the kind of big idea that Whittingham had of like a lithium ion energy storage, the cathode that Dr. Goodenough had, and then a carbon anode, and then put them together and made the modern battery. So instead of having lithium metal, you could store the lithium in carbon and you could bring it back. Then you could say there are like two more advances since then. So in 1990, Professor Jeff Dahn, who's currently the one who works really closely with Tesla, figured out a way you could use graphite instead of the type of carbon they were using before, which was like coke, like charcoal more. Using graphite was a really big advance that actually like made the battery way better. And then the big thing also, which was once you try to start making enough batteries for all the cars in the world, you run out of cobalt really quickly. And so cobalt's kind of expensive and rare. And so you can actually read in like the original papers Dr. Goodenough published, he was basically like, you could use cobalt or you could use like nickel maybe, but nickel's got a lot of problems. And so the big technological breakthrough over the last 20 years was figuring out how to make nickel oxide work instead of cobalt oxide. And so actually the same guy, Jeff Dahn, played a big role in that. And they figured out that you could mix manganese and cobalt to stabilize it. Actually, one of the other big ones came from argon, which was NCA. So they figured out you mix it with cobalt and aluminum, you could stabilize it. I think that was Professor Khalil Amin. So I said, we started in the 70s and we got till now. And I said, those five material level breakthroughs are like the main ones that cover like all of the advances on the electrochemistry side. Now we're trying to figure out where to go next. So the cathode that we have is really good. I don't see a clear competitor. It's the industry has settled on these nickel rich oxides. And then the anode is like where people are trying to figure out if they can make a breakthrough. So some people say that like lithium metal, the reason they started with that is it's the best. It's like really light. You don't have any of this extra stuff that weighs down the battery and takes up a bunch of space. And so if we could just figure out how to cycle that in a safe way, then it would be the highest energy we could possibly get. And so we should just go for lithium metal. It's obvious that is an attractive thing. And then the other class of people are people who are doing alloying anodes, mostly silicon. And they're basically saying, so it was really good that we came up with a host material to hold the lithium. Like we don't want a bunch of lithium metal in the battery. And although the graphite is as good as we can get right now, if we were using something like silicon, it could store way more lithium. I think the kind of clear examples of this, if I were to say from a commercial standpoint, it's like QuantumScape and Solid Power are two that come to mind for working on stabilizing lithium metal. So the main thing that people tried to do is one of the big things that catches on fire in a battery is the electrolyte. You could imagine it's like paint thinner. So you have these two electrodes sitting in a bunch of paint thinner, and then like if it catches on fire, the paint thinner burns a lot, and that's bad. So they were saying, if we get rid of the paint thinner, then we could probably make lithium metal safe because we don't have to worry as much about the flammable organic solvents. So they were trying to use like a solid electrolyte. So instead of using a paint thinner, they would use like a little piece of ceramic. That's really hard. I see a lot of problems with solid electrolytes. It seems like a lot of people have made incredible progress, and some of the stuff QuantumScape has shown has been good. But it seems like even QuantumScape is using silps and paint thinner because the paint thinner is good in the cathode. They still put a little bit of paint thinner, but it's mostly gone to try to eliminate the safety. But the other approach is the silicon anodes. It holds a lot more lithium than graphite, but it's not super robust and like it can crumble and pulverize. If you try to put lithium into a big wafer of silicon, it would just turn into silicon powder on like the first cycle, and then it kind of falls apart. So people have tried to figure out how they could use this material that can hold a lot of lithium and actually turn that into an electrode that can stably cycle a bunch of times. So you want to put lithium in and pull it out a whole bunch of times. You need to make sure that it can be good density and all these other things. And so a big way people have tried to do this is nanostructuring. I think the most prominent company in that space is like Sila Nanotechnologies. They're also really smart, spun out of Georgia Tech, and they're basically trying to build a nanostructure which holds together the silicon and work. And they do that, they don't talk a lot about what they do, but they started with a chemical vapor deposition process using silane gas. So one of the big problems with that approach is just, like I said, it's really capital intensive. If you said, I want to make a megaton of nanomaterial, it costs a lot. It's like really hard to make thousands and thousands of tons of something when it needs to have this precise control over all the operating conditions. And so I pioneered like a new approach. And I say that I'm the only one who works on it. It's pretty out there. Like most of the time, if I tell people in the battery space about it, they're really confused. They kind of get what I'm saying. But what I'm doing is very different. And so I was working with a really brilliant grad student in my first year, Dr. Carl Kreter. And we were talking, and one of the ideas he was really playing around with was, could you use like metalworking to make nanomaterials? And so metallurgy is like really the foundation of material science. That's where the field grew out of. But not a lot of people work explicitly on metallurgy anymore. And the first approach we had tried was we melted together two metals that like didn't like to mix. And so this is like aluminum and tin. And then when they cool down, they split into little pockets of aluminum and tin. and then we just rolled it into a foil. What that did was make a nanostructured foil. And that's a really easy process. Like, you're melting metals and you're rolling foils. Like, you have aluminum foil in your house and they sell it to you at the same price as aluminum. So this is really different than what almost any other electrode design is. Like, most people are designing these powders that kind of replace graphite. We're trying to make these foils that have a cool structure that could hold a lot of lithium. So they're immediately like, when you sit down, if you first hear the idea, you can come up with 10 problems that you're like, would it have good capacity retention? Could you put lithium into it really quickly? Could it cycle for 100 cycles? Would it expand too much? And so what my thesis was, me basically trying to see if foils could meet all of the characteristics that you would need for them to actually be viable. This isn't a really common field of research, but really it's existing at this intersection of metallurgy and batteries. And that's what I'm putting forward as the approach that I think honestly is like perfectly suited for what the industry needs, is these nanostructured metal foils. They have the possibility of being really safe, so you don't have the problems of lithium metal where it can spontaneously ignite in a catastrophic way. They have really high energy density, like the promise of some of those silicon ones. It's really dense, and so you can get a lot of energy in a small space. It's really simple, and it works with the infrastructure that already exists. So I think there's like 300 billion infrastructure. And like right now, the anode is a copper foil with graphite powder on it. And I'm saying, like, what if you replace the copper foil with my foil? And so you could theoretically do that with all the same lines. Like, you might have to do some adjustments, but the broad shape of my technology fits in with what they do already. And in fact, one of the nice things is all those big expensive slurry coating machines that I had talked about that you're not using to make the anodes anymore, because you don't need to coat the copper foil. You can use those for your cathodes. So I'm not even saying you need to get rid of the infrastructure you have. You can repurpose it and then double your throughput for the production of cathodes, and get like a really cheap way to make a lot of anode. And basically that's like the field broadly. So that's the, how do we electrify transport? And that's all the cars in the world, all the scooters, all the bikes. Like, one of the things that I'm really excited about is the idea of every scooter in Hanoi being an electric scooter. You have huge improvements in air quality. You have a significant reduction in global emissions. You can also just make it really cheap. So I think one of the best-selling cars in China right now is a little $5,000 electric vehicle that has a 100-mile range. If you can get a car that can drive you 100 miles for $5,000, that's like a good deal. Even smart cars, which like didn't take off in the US, they're like $25,000, I think, because you still have to build an engine and all this other stuff. But just electric vehicles, like a battery on wheels, you can do that pretty cheaply if you want a small one. Like, electric bikes are also a really cool technology that I think are pretty amazing. I think human on a bike is the most efficient form of transport until the electric bike. I do think that electric bikes charged off solar are like more efficient energy-wise than even a normal bicycle. So that's really cool too. But if you're talking about like some of the most ambitious problems, one of the big ones, which is like hard, is trying to figure out how to store wind and solar. The lithium ion battery is really good when like things need to move around. And like all those technologies that I just mentioned are broadly lithium ion batteries. The lithium metal one's probably a little bit different, but it's like lithium ion mediated. But how do you store all the wind and solar in the world? Is you just need it to be dirt cheap. Like I said, if it's fallen to like $100 a kilowatt hour, that's considered an amazing accomplishment. People want $5 a kilowatt hour or less. One company, which is cool, which I don't know almost anything about, but at least like I said, they're seriously trying, it seems, is like Form Energy. Like, they're trying to do something that would have the shape that could store energy at that cost. But overall, that's one of the most challenging outstanding problems in batteries, I think, is trying to figure out how to store energy at the scale needed for massive grid scale shifting. A lot of the times with stuff like this, the safest bet is that you're just going to use the same types of batteries that are in cars, and we'll have to find other solutions, because like battery technology is really difficult. But at the same time, I think that it's super important work that like anyone studying grid scale batteries and like trying to figure out how to do that, that's a really important thing.
What do you think is holding things back in the whole starting solar and wind dirt cheap, as you said? Is it also, again, like funding, research? Is it not enough people studying it?
To some extent, probably. It's also just really hard. So it's like, you can be like, oh, it would be great if we had a battery that was 20 times cheaper. It's, yeah, it would be. Oh, but like, it's still not super obvious how you do that, in like the same way for almost any of these things, where if you're like, it would be great if we had a car that drove 20 times faster. And it's, there are a lot of problems with that. You can't just make cars drive 20 times faster. If everyone was doing that, I'd be like, it's not clear how to do that immediately. And there are good ideas and there are definitely things to try, but it's just a really demanding constraints. Especially, so one of the things, which at least having thought about commercialization of my technology a lot, is like one of the things which is nice is if you are not competing on cost and you can identify premium markets where you can extract margins and people are willing to pay more. If you're just trying to be a dirt cheap commodity, it's like pretty difficult to have something that actually can be self-sustaining. And because almost all of these technologies have significant learning curves. There's a really good article, which I don't know if you have show notes or something you can link, which was talking about how clean energy got so cheap. And really, it's just mostly a factor of the scale it was deployed at. And so once you build the first gigawatt hour solar facility, it's easier to build the next ones. It gets cheaper. And so starting out any of these things is hard. And if your only pitch is like, it would be a lot cheaper, then you need like really compelling evidence that it actually would be. But just from a scientific perspective as well, it's just said a very challenging problem. But that's not to say that it's not like 100% people should be working on it. But there's so many other things too, just for clarity's sake, where one of the big things you also want, if you want techno-economically viable grid scale storage, is like energy efficiency actually matters a lot. So your car, you don't really care. If you put in 100 kilowatt hours, but you only get 85 in your battery pack, you don't really care. You care about the range of your car. It's not like you're paying too much attention. But if you're just moving massive quantities of grid scale energy, anything that you're losing as far as the round trip efficiency just cuts into your overall profits. Because if the solar guy gives you 100 kilowatt hours and you give him back 50 to sell, then you've like lost a lot of money that you could have gained. So some of the approaches that people have tried with these big things called flow batteries, one of their problems is like they're not very efficient. You have all these pumps and you have all these moving parts and stuff, and it's just complicated and difficult, as opposed to like Tesla, which is just throw this box in your garage and it'll sit there. And it just, you can buy 100 boxes if you want. If you're a government, we'll sell you 10,000 fridges and all these fridges sit next to each other. That's a technology which is already being deployed at the scale. So it's cheap-ish. We're going to have to figure out how to make do with it. But just as an outstanding, ambitious effort, like grids, anyone who's working on grid scale energy storage has a really difficult problem set line up for them. That was actually what I had originally. When I got into the battery space, I wanted to do stuff that was grid scale. The thing that actually was the image in mind was I did a lot of traveling when I was younger. And I saw, if you go to Vietnam, you'll see like a big stand and there's like a internal combustion engine sitting outside it that's just spewing out black smoke that they use to like power it. That doesn't seem very good. It seems like solar and batteries would probably be better. But just looking at the shape of the lithium ion battery technology, you can see it's like perfectly fit for transportation. Everything is lined up to the point where electric vehicles are just going to dominate transportation, especially road transport. So we can talk about planes and electric aviation stuff later, too, which is definitely cool. And that's another one which is like hard to do the math for. I have a buddy who's really into eVTOLs. And you just see him like trying to figure out ways to like, can't you give me more energy? Like, please. It's like, I don't know. It's like really hard. There's definitely some, and there's like cool efforts there as well. And it's something where I've grown more bullish on electric aviation. But my take is you need to do weird stuff. Like you need like laminar flow, which is like a weird thing, which makes them more efficient. But overall, the electrification of cars, trucks, and bikes at this point is pretty straightforward. I think that basically the breakthroughs that I'm talking about, like lithium metal and silicon, they'll push it over the edge where you'll just, if anyone successfully brings one to market, you're going to just see such massive adoption. But even without a breakthrough on that nature, just looking at a lot of the trends, it seems like that's something that's going to happen. And it's huge. Like I said, that's 25% of global emissions is transportation. Mm-hmm. And you still have to power it with cleaner energy, but it gives you the ability to do road transport without needing to emit. How I see the field is, like I said, started out in like the premium products like phones and laptops. I think the first lithium ion battery was sold by Sony for a camcorder, which was like a very premium, fancy product at the time. And the battery only lasted 100 charges, but it's gotten a lot better since then. Then Tesla really was the one who said, we think this is going to work. We're just going to do it and it's going to work. And they were right. They started producing it at the scale. Price fell. They were ahead of the game on that. And they are very competent people who have thought about this seriously. And so that is one of the things where we were talking before about like the lack of seriousness in some academic circles. Like if you're a company like that, you have to be serious. You don't really have the luxury of being untethered and just doing whatever. Like they needed to make a product and they did. And now the rest of the whole industry is starting to catch up. Different players at different levels of sophistication with this, but that's definitely something that's going to happen. So I think the big ambitious effort that's like achievable. Clearly, it's not obvious how to do it, but it seems like it's going to happen, is figure out how to power all the vehicles in the world using batteries. Then the next step is, like I said, trying to do the grid scale storage stuff, and electric aviation are two examples of very ambitious hard problems, which will take a lot of creative thinking and maybe some outside the box approach, because just doing the consensus won't really get us there. The consensus is lithium metal, silicon, alloy anodes broadly. Like, that's going to do it for cars. And I think part of the thing is, like, one of the things the eVTOL friend talks about is, he's like, all of the battery people want all the airplane guys to be more efficient, and all the airplane guys want the batteries to be a lot better. And so everyone's, oh, no, don't worry, they'll solve it. They'll just make an airplane that's like 20 times less drag. Because, like, I can't do the battery thing you're asking me for, but you guys can handle it. And I think it's the meeting in the middle. So basically, I think the battery guys will have to push batteries as far, better guys and gals. The battery people will push batteries as far as they can, and the grid people will get really creative, and they'll have to figure out how to work with what is given to them. And I think, like, those less obvious solutions or problems or stuff that's just going to be hard.
Do you see them, like, intermingling as well? Do you see the communication being a fundamental issue, kind of like both sides waiting on one another to advance research so they can make advances as well? Do you think there should be, like, some field almost set up, or some efforts at least for communication to improve?
Yeah, I think improved communication would be great, especially, like, the explicit communication of what's needed is something which isn't great. One of the, like, I critique a lot of, like I said, saying, like, some of the battery research is less practical, but sometimes it's just the people don't know, like, they're not running multinational corporations producing products and trying to at least figure out what actually is valued. One thing you, like, for a startup in general, it's trying to figure out what the customer actually wants is not always super obvious. And you need to do a lot of discovery and talk to a lot of people and put in concerted effort to figure that out. And so I think that better communication would be good, but, like, trying to figure out how to align the incentives, because if you are a huge company, like, you might not want to go teach random scientists what's important. Like, you have your own life and a lot of things you're trying to work out and you're trying to get through the day. And then at the same time, if you're a scientist who is studying a really interesting problem and you don't really need to be told what to do by some commercial player who is looking for a more narrow set of goals. All this stuff's hard. I think better communication is clearly important. I think the few conversations I had with market leaders during the development of my product really guided development. A clear example. So batteries, you can store energy, and you can talk about the energy by, like, energy in a given space or energy in a given weight. And so it's 1 kilogram of batteries. How much does that store versus 1 liter of batteries? How much does that store? And so within the same chemistry, they're, like, broadly pretty tied. So you make it better, it gets better at both. But one of the big things is every paper you'll see almost talks about the energy in a given weight as the thing. And the main reason that was, like, talked about at first is it's, like, way easier to measure because you just weigh your electrodes before you build them into the battery and you talk about it. But actually, if you think about it, for consumer electronics, where batteries started, it's actually doesn't really matter how much it weighs. You just want it to be thinner. So if you talk to any of the consumer electronics people, like, volumetric energy density is all they care about. And actually, as it turns out, with electric vehicles, weight doesn't really matter either. Weight primarily determines 0 to 60 time. No one's critique of Tesla is that their cars aren't fast enough, but the space of the battery pack is what determines the range. And so for the two biggest markets, it's like energy density is all that matters, but almost no one ever talks about it and no one, like, really discusses it in any detail. And hearing that, like I said, so my technology, I've, like, pretty explicitly optimized for energy density for those two markets. I actually wonder if I tell this story. Sure, why not? I was at a conference. I was talking to someone broadly in the consumer electronics space who was highlighting that energy density is all that matters. And then during the conference, an academic was presenting and they basically were talking about batteries broadly. And the consumer electronics person asked the academic about the energy density, and the academic, and this is to a big crowd, so the academic didn't know who he was speaking to, explains that consumer electronics doesn't care about energy density and they only want more energy in a given weight, which was directly in contrast to what this person who clearly knew was telling me. And also what, like, common sense tells you. You don't care if your iPhone weighs an extra 8 grams. Like, that's just not a huge problem. And there is a mixture of, it's an artifact of it being easier to measure. There's also the fact they're generally pretty tied. And so it's usually not super important to distinguish between them. But then there's also some where it's a lot of these battery chemistries look a lot better if you talk about them in a given weight. Like one that our group does great work on, and we've engaged with this pretty explicitly, is lithium sulfur batteries were like something considered as a next generation. They're actually stellar on the weight thing. You could probably the highest energy you can possibly get. And so that's why I'm really bullish on them for applications that matters. Like drones, the weight matters a lot. Like it's not useless to make a battery, which is really light. That's super important. But lithium sulfur batteries are generally really bad on the volume thing. So like when you start branching out to these other chemistries, that can be a problem. So broadly speaking, having people in industry talk to people in academia and having more avenues for understanding what's good, I think is important. Because also, so I said, like my chemistry, like I said, is really good on that energy density, but it's about the same on the gravimetric, which kind of sucks because drones would be a perfect beachhead market for a startup. If you actually can sell a product which is like way more energy in a given weight, that's like ideal for customers that have a significant incentive to adopt your tech. That's why I really try to like think like from a startup perspective, that's an attractive thing. I still do think that volumetric energy density is probably more important. The whole reason that I'm working on this is I believe that's what the most important problems need. But I think putting people who have problems related to a field in touch with the people working on the field can help you to find unique, interesting ways that both people can grow.
Yeah, definitely. No, that makes a lot of sense. And expanding on that point too, what is the implicit knowledge in your field that you feel like holds generally true, but is not explicitly stated? Like perhaps some other points you can think of where stuff has to be learned anew through experience by everyone entering the field, but there's no real reason why it wouldn't just be written down or communicated more explicitly.
If you like read any of the stuff that I had written about that open source Wikipedia thing, it pretty explicitly is that where I was pretty frustrated that nothing was written down and everyone was reinventing the wheel in their own lab all the time. And then you would just learn from the grad student who was there before they left. And then you'd hope that person didn't leave before telling someone who was interested. Because there's like, all this equipment lying around our lab. No one knows how to use. Just been there forever. You see it in the back corner. So there's a lot of tacit knowledge, which is just super important. I learned from that scientist, Dr. Carl Kreeter, who was very bright. And I think he knew batteries really well. And we worked together for the first year that I was doing my PhD. And he taught me everything that I needed to succeed. Without having his mentorship, I wouldn't have known. So one thing, which is if you want super granular, that's like for any battery scientist, what I say is the super specific piece of advice is like, the electrochemistry really tells you everything. Like the voltage profiles, when you're looking at it, it's like a super high fidelity characterization technique that almost no one looks at. Even in our lab, a lot of people like never look at the charging and discharging profiles. But I would say almost all of my major advances come from looking at that. That was just something that like Carl really emphasized was like, you should pay attention to like anything that's happening there is important and meaningful. And that's something which like isn't really discussed in papers to the same extent, although some very good groups do. I think that at least trying to know what's important and what to emphasize is something which is one of the biggest things. So one thing which I don't like, which a lot of papers do, is they'll do this technique called XPS and they just get pretty pictures. And like a lot of times they don't like really dive into the analysis. And like XPS is a super powerful technique. But one thing where I'm like, it doesn't seem like the greatest use of resources unless you're asking a tailored question, I think. And overall, I think one of the big things is there are a lot of really smart people and just trying to find the smart people who know something really well and have put in the time, like learning from them is what's great. And I think trying to figure out ways that to get the really smart people to write stuff down is important. Like an example of someone who I think is great, who's active on Twitter for batteries, like Matt Lacey. He wrote a whole blog post on how he thinks about and does EIS. I think it's like one of the best introductions to EIS. It's not really a textbook. It's not really just a simple brief paragraph. It's like he goes through and like talks about all that stuff. So I do think with the internet, there's a lot more tools for communication of tacit knowledge. There's a really good essay by Sam Oberja talking about the YouTube revolution and knowledge transfer, talking about how you can teach a lot of that stuff, which is hard to put into words and the internet in a lot of ways. But I think that the big one that I stuck with when I was thinking about it was like experimental methods. It's just like, how do you actually do the thing like physically? If you want to do ICP, are there clear step-by-step instructions that are written down and available for people? And the answer is no. And so that was what I had hoped to do. But overall, I think that I had decided that I should probably focus commercializing a new battery technology and not build a new Wikipedia at the same time. So trying to focus.
Might be a little too much on a plate. But to that, are there any efforts that you'd like to highlight? Or is this really just a call to action perhaps for others to attack this problem? Because I do think it's like a pretty big bottleneck to a lot of progress happening in multiple scientific fields.
Overall, I think any of the meta science stuff, there's a lot of cool people who are thinking about it, like writing online. I know people that come to mind as good thinkers on it, like somebody like that David Chapman guy, Patrick Collison, the head of Stripe, does a lot of thinking about this stuff too. Tyler Cowen is another economist who thinks about this. They like are working on like progress studies is what it's broadly called. Peter Thiel is another one who thinks a lot about this innovation stuff. Kevin Simler actually had the blog post that inspired me to make that open source science Wikipedia, which was modeling knowledge transmission actually as like the spread of a disease. This was before COVID time. I think all this stuff's hard. I think basically if you see something you can do to try to improve, you should do that. And just like doing your best to help figure out ways to disseminate knowledge is important. I think mentorship is pretty explicitly what is important as well. One of the things I liked, if you talk about like diversification, so people don't say battery guys, it's really starts at the top of the funnel. And so I think explicitly reaching out to people, the reason I do research is I got hired into a lab when I was a freshman in college by a very kind professor, Peter Kofinos, who kicked off my whole career. I wouldn't have learned any of the things I did without the mentorship that he and his lab provided. And I think that's really important, is just basically trying to find ways to get people into the system such that they can start learning and start being exposed to it and pick up all the things that aren't explicitly taught often, which are like difficult to explicitly teach. Even when you're like around people, you pick up the language, you pick up the different things you say that makes you in the in-group within whatever you're doing. And I think mentorship is something which is hard to do in a depersonalized way at scale. But also like some people, so one group, which you'll see me even on Twitter, I was like hyping up a lot and just in general, I've never even met the guy, but he is very smart, is Jeff Dahn. And like Jeff Dahn writes these papers where it's a guide to full coin cell making for academic researchers. Like no one writes papers like that. That's just like, I read it. I'm like, that's a good paper. Like you just like, huh. And like, he had a similar one about blade casting electrodes and he didn't publish them in like prestige, super high impact journals, but they were great. There are definitely people who, even within the academy, like explicitly trying to communicate important information. And obviously everyone is most of the time, like 99% of papers are written with good intentions and people trying to communicate important information there as well. But I do really like the people who are trying to help take some of that stuff that exists in the ether and is communicated in random rooms and make it concrete and put it into a medium where more people can benefit from it.
So on that note of, I guess, implicit, explicit, and your own coming into the field, are there any particular framework shifts you remember that you went through that really had an impact on how you approach life or your research, even like your startup now, that you'd wish to highlight?
There was a really good blog post about scientific advances, which was talking about the importance of these like ontological shifts and like the way mm-hmm. you view the world. And I remember there was a couple that are funny. So when I first started in material science as an undergrad, people would ask you like, what's material science? And like most people don't know, and you have 5 seconds to give an answer. What I had said was it used to be like metallurgy, but all that stuff's boring. But now it's cool stuff like nanotechnology and biomaterials and like crazy advanced cutting edge stuff. And then I remember when I was going into batteries, one of the things I would joke is like, I don't want to do consumer electronics. Like I'm not trying to make an iPhone like a millimeter slimmer. Like I want to work on like the wind and solar stuff and cars. And then I basically became a metallurgist who does high energy batteries for consumer electronics. It's like definitely one of the things where I also used to joke about how I didn't care at all about business. And now I've started a company to commercialize my technology. So basically anything I joke that I don't want to do quickly comes down the pipe at me. So I think those are some big shifts. So actually there was an explicit time when I realized that I was doing metallurgy and I was a metallurgist. Like that was something which I never even came close to identifying with until later on. And actually the biggest breakthrough in my thesis was something where I actually reproduced a paper from like the US Army wrote in the 1940s. And like that was something which was like a metallurgy thing, which was really cool and worked well. So overall, that was a big one. I think I'm still in more of a shift to trying to be more commercially minded. And one of the big things which kind of drives that is where all the impact is. So my goal is that my technology powers all of the vehicles in the world, because that would give cleaner air, reduce pollution of all this positive stuff. But you don't do that by writing papers. You can kick that off. But like a big thing is it's hard to commercialize research. It's really difficult to take something and then actually bring it into the world. And that is where business and capitalism and startups and stuff actually does well. If you can like line up all the incentives, then it actually becomes real in a way in which I think is both challenging and exciting. So the importance of business is something I'm learning more and more about as well.
It's so crucial. And I think a very underhyped, at least within the realms of academia, probably. So how do you think, like, maybe you can paint a picture of a day, let's say 30 years from now, where your technology has worked out and a lot of the world's motors are powered by your batteries and potentially like other breakthroughs as well. How will the everyday person's life change?
So realistically, I think the clearest ways would be more advanced. Consumer electronics is probably the place where you'll get new stuff in the way where like AirPods only exist because batteries got good enough that you could power a wireless sensor for a long time that would play music in a very small form factor, like drones or something, which is also becoming much more prominent as batteries become cheaper and better. Electric vehicles just have significant improvements for the user experience in comparison to cars in a lot of ways. I think that just streamlined, like you'll probably almost never go to the gas station because, like I said, your car is just always full and ready to go. You also don't have to go to the mechanic. Mechanics are a pain sometimes. They're opaque, and so my EGR valve is broken. I'm like, I'm having to Google what an EGR valve is, and it like recirculates inert gas to the, I'm like, I don't know what that is either. Sure, I guess I give you $900 now. That's fine. But like a car, an electric vehicle is just a battery on wheels. So I do think that the most transformative, crazy stuff that you could imagine would be if you actually can nail eVTOL, like electric vertical takeoff and lift aircrafts, because then you just made the flying car. If you only have a 60-mile range, if you can just fly to work, that's pretty transformative. And that is something where, like, I've grown more optimistic than I was, but like, it's still definitely a hard problem. I think that you'll see increasing penetration of a lot of wearables and more diverse consumer electronics. So one thing which may have been a complete rumor but excited me was people had suggested the new Apple Watch might have an optical blood glucometer for measuring your blood sugar throughout the day. And at first I was like, oh, I thought that was impossible, because like, I actually used to work in biosensors and I didn't know that was a thing. And then someone on Twitter was like, no, check this out. And they sent me like, actually the eVTOL guy, Tapa Ghosh, very smart guy. But he sent this book basically that was written by this guy who describes the blueprint for developing an optical blood glucometer. And he basically suggested it would probably, he thought, take $25 to $50 million in 5 years. And like Apple could do that. That's something which is super feasible. The thing which is cool about batteries is they're primitive. So like having something which provides more energy on demand safely, it gives people a tool that they can get really creative with. And like when Dr. Goodenough invented the lithium ion battery, he didn't think about drones or cell phones. He didn't even probably think about laptops. Like cars were the big one that people thought about. If you read the early stuff where that was actually, electric cars were the inspiration. Even Thomas Edison was like trying to work on an electric car. So like people have been trying to do electric cars since before internal combustion engine cars were a thing. That's always been the main goal. But like all of the consumer electronic stuff just came out of the lithium ion battery. That was the technology that enabled this. It's like Benchmark Minerals always talks about. So they're like, they talk a lot about battery material supply. I think they're the ones who always say it's like a platform technology. So like higher and improved performance in batteries is a platform upon which you can build all kinds of different technologies. So the cool thing will probably be something that I didn't come up with just in my brainstorm 30 years from now, because some very smart person realized that things were now possible that were previously not considered possible, and they wouldn't do that. But the big one I think about is all of the scooters in Hanoi, for whatever reason. Like I just imagine, because there are a lot, it's like a lot of smoke, it's really loud and crazy. But if you just imagine, we already have actually had some conversations in our lab with an electric rickshaw manufacturer, and you're reaching economic parity for a lot of those markets, just because you can strap some batteries on like a bike, like I said, really easily. And then it's also cheaper. So the reason that people want to adopt electric rickshaws is also due to volatility in fuel prices. So they don't like the fact that all of a sudden they're having to pay way more. Electricity is more consistent in price. So there's this huge economic incentive to not spend a bunch of money on expensive fuel all the time. And that's the transformation which I am most excited to see. Is like I said, like people talk about micromobility, like the Lime scooters. But if you think about micromobility, you shouldn't think about Palo Alto. You should think about Cairo. Cairo is the place where micromobility is going to have a major, major impact, because people don't already have a bunch of cars and want more big, bulky cars. They're like much more willing to adopt smaller vehicles. So that's definitely the thing that I think of.
Exactly. I think that's actually a very powerful thing. Having one very vivid, even if it's like a very niche image in mind, like the scooters in Hanoi or something like that, I think that provides one with a lot of like motivation. I think that's way more impactful than we usually think about. And I think travel is definitely very important to see how the technologies that might be developed in the sometimes bubbles of Silicon Valley can actually have a way bigger impact for people across the globe. I'm curious, what don't I know that I don't know? What important questions have I not asked in your opinion so far?
Nothing really comes to mind, at least trying to like kick around the thought of something that we haven't covered. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess here's the thing, if you want to keep tying it back to climate, a big thing that is also important, which is batteries, but not really batteries, is a lot of industrial chemical processes need to decarbonize as well. And electrochemical techniques for those are one of the most promising ways to do that. I know actually my PhD advisor's son is at MIT. He's a professor and he's doing some research on electrochemical Haber-Bosch, which is a way that you can make nitrogen fertilizer using electrochemistry. You can go to a lot lower temperatures. That's like a big holy grail. And there's also a lot of stuff where people are trying to do electrochemical methods for making fuels. You have like direct air capture and stuff. And broadly speaking, electrochemistry, which exists at the interface of energy and chemistry, which is a banal statement, is going to be a really powerful technique as we try to electrify the economy. So there's a friend of mine who's working on some like negative emissions stuff, trying to figure out how to deploy money to suck carbon out of the sky. But there's some potential like electrochemical approaches for that too. Overall, just from the making explicit the fact that the field that exists at the interface of energy and chemistry, which is like the world, is something which is super important as we try to figure out how to move to a more sustainable future.
That's certainly super exciting. On a more personal note, what ideas, areas, books, or even life experiences are you most excited about right now?
From the past or looking forward, or just in general? I guess
in general, yeah. You can take it to the past, to the future, whatever you like.
I'm very excited to get a vaccine at some point. I think that's going to be really cool. I've been at home and working a lot, and that's like something which I think is very tangible. It's a really impressive accomplishment. Honestly, like if you like read about RNA vaccines, there was actually a really great interview with one of the co-founders of Moderna. It's super impressive. And like the fact that this technology has such a tangible impact, these people invented this thing in a lab, and then you're going to get a shot in your arm and you're going to like see your family. You can stop the whole society from crumbling. That's a really exciting thing. It's like somewhat in the context of the fact that the current day-to-day is not the best, but that's something which when I saw the first like pictures of like on Instagram of a friend getting the vaccine, I was very pumped. And then I'm excited for just the whole journey of, so I'm wrapping up my thesis in the next couple weeks, hopefully, but I'm also spinning out a startup, trying to commercialize my technology, and then getting the chance to really seriously focus on. So if I say that I actually believe my technology could power all the vehicles in the world and have this whole big impact, one of the important things is to do something about that. I should actually be like really aggressively like trying to push this, because this could be really big and important. And I spent all this time, like I said, I spent the last 4 years trying to basically figure out a way this wouldn't work, and I have failed. It still seems like it could work, which is pretty cool. I'm like, oh, nice.
Absolutely. Awesome. And as someone like further advanced down the trajectory, what's something nobody will tell me that I should know? What is something you discovered in your life that maybe society, employers, friends concealed, maybe not even willingly, that is important to know in your opinion?
See, gang, the hard one. Oh, here's a good one. I think no one knows how to do science. That's actually the thing that David Chapman talks about. People think about like the scientific method and like you do that sometimes. But it's not like, like I sit around in the lab and I'm like, let's come up with null hypotheses today and try to falsify them. It's not really, it's a weird creative thing where you're just trying to figure something out. And like people don't, that's also why it's hard to teach, like the whole explicit thing. So there's a really good essay, I think, in the context of that called Upgrade Your Cargo Cult for the Win by that David Chapman guy, which talks about how scientific innovation happens. And I really like the model that he put forth is one that really resonated with me. But that's one that I would say is the scientific method is a sham. No one knows anything. We're all just trying to wing it.
I guess in that context, yeah, I was reading a book called Against the Method by Paul Feyerabend. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but it also talks a lot about basically the absence of method or the idealization of science as like a really, I guess I was always taught it was like a very abstract thing and like all scientists had it figured out basically. And then talking to people in the real world, the facade tends to crumble down quite fast. And I think that's also like a good thing to communicate more because you have all these kids that think it's like a very unapproachable thing that could actually probably provide a lot of value as well, if only they knew that it wasn't this picture perfect image and struggling is okay. So do you think, lastly, maybe that it's more important to know the written explicit rules or maybe the unwritten implicit rules? And what is an unwritten rule you discovered in your life?
I would say if I was ranking importance, I would say the unwritten rules are more important only because they're harder to find. The written rules are easy because they're just there. And so a lot of the times you can just broadly try to figure out what it is. I think that honestly, so a guy who I like a lot about this is Nicholas Nassim Taleb. He writes complexity science and stuff. And so you can't put everything into words. And I think trusting your gut is something which sometimes people say it's like, oh, unscientific and we have all these biases. But like our biases are there for a reason. And I think that the world and everything is super high fidelity and there's so much information communicated non-verbally just in every like a million ways. So one of the things is you can't write all the rules down. This is one of the things that I have learned. Even if you tried to and you like spent your whole life, you couldn't even come close. And just accepting that the complexity of the world is so much more than we can really handle, that that's something where that's true in almost all facets. I think it's also something where one of the cool things about Leb's book series is he tries to apply this grappling of the complexity of the world to a whole bunch of different fields. So although his first book is more about like finance and risk and stuff, and his, I guess it's his third in the series, Anti-Fragile, he tries to apply this same thing to diet and medicine and exercise and hiring and all of these other things. I think he is one of the best at communicating some of these unwritten rules because he tells very colorful anecdotes. Smart guy. And like I said, obviously, like I said, there's always limitations with any kind of framing or mental model. But yeah, you can't put everything in words. Well, I don't know. That's at least where my mind went.
Definitely a great point. Yeah, we will link to everything discussed, all the articles and all of that. Brian, thank you so much for having been here. It was super, super fascinating. And thanks for taking your time.
Of course. Yeah, no, it was really fun. Glad to take the time. Hopefully you have a nice day and we both get shot soon. Medical marvels.
I hope so.